It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have an old-time friend of the podcast rejoining us this time. He was on the early days of the podcast, episodes 9 and 52, back in 2017. He has had quite a lot of success since then, as we will discuss. He is a popular Twitch streamer, YouTube channel haver. He has 85,000 YouTube subs, 95,000 Twitch subs, of course, a popular commentator. Over the board, he was the co-champion of the 1994 and 2007 U.S. Opens, as well as the 2002 World Open, and he is the co-founder of the Chess Club and Scholastic Center of Atlanta. Back on the podcast, Grandmaster Ben Feingold. Thanks for rejoining us.
Hey, Ben. Anytime, and especially, not only do I like you, but your name's Ben, so you get special treatment.
Okay. I'll accept whatever charity you're willing to give, so I appreciate that, Ben. And yeah, it's good to catch up. So much has changed over the years, both in the chess world and with you in particular. I mean, you've had so much success, which I'm happy to see. And I encourage listeners who, of course, Ben is, there's no shortage of Ben Feingold content available for listeners to listen to or watch or whatever your preferred method of media may be. But I encourage listeners to listen to our old interviews, as Ben was not even Twitch streaming at the beginning and was just starting the Scholastic Center and Chess Club in Atlanta. So you can get some background there, and we're going to get back into that stuff. But Ben, I actually want to begin with your pursuit of the Grandmaster title back in the aughts, as I believe they are called.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking a lot. We had, like, I am Lawrence Trent, and I am Sean Nagel, and I am Attila Terzo in a recent episode, talked about their chase for the GM. And of course, we have a lot of listeners as adults fighting the eternal battle to improve at chess as they get older. And you are one of the oldest players to attain the Grandmaster title. And we have not talked on this podcast about that journey. So could you walk us through that struggle?
Yeah, I could make up a good story, which I do a lot. But I guess since this is a podcast, I'll just tell it like it is. unlike the other people you mentioned, 95% of people who become grandmasters, that rarely interests me. So I didn't do what other people do to get the grandmaster title. I played in chess tournaments. I studied chess. I did what you have to do. But I didn't say there's a norm tournament, there's a norm tournament, there's a norm tournament, and if I can get norms, I'll become a grandmaster. And one of the reasons that wasn't on my mind, like it probably would be now if I was in my 20s and 30s and I was an IM, is that Unlike now, it was very difficult to get GM norms if you're an American, unless you went to Europe. And unfortunately, when I did go to Europe, because I lived there from 88 to 92, before most of the listeners were born, I lived in Brussels, Belgium. I was an FM and I was getting IM norms everywhere. So I basically became I did the opposite of what most Americans do. I became an IM in Europe and a GM in America. And nowadays, because of the St. Louis Club, because of the Charlotte Chess Center, and because the Continental Chess Association run by Bill Goitschberg, he's made some of his tournaments that were 5 or 7 rounds, 9 rounds, so you can get a GM norm. So now if you live, and also I should also point out, there's many, many, many more foreign chess players in the U.S. than 20, 30 years ago because of Susan Polgar with her SPICE program and the fact that she was at Texas Tech and then Webster. And the St. Louis University has that. There's 2 or 3 schools in Texas. UMBC started it all. So there's so many foreign players in the U.S., and it doesn't mean that they're stronger. They are stronger, but that wasn't my point. My point was, if you want to get GM norms, half of it is playing good chess. And the other half, which was very difficult to do in the U.S. 20, 30 years ago, was find a 9-round tournament with lots of grandmasters, with lots of foreign players, because there's a lot of rules about becoming a GM. And I didn't say, well, I need to become a GM. I have to go to Europe and play in 10 norm tournaments. That's the main reason it took me so long, because I wasn't really trying. I wasn't spending all the money in the world to become a GM. And my rating, FIDE and USCF spoke for themselves. So as long as my colleagues knew that I was a GM without the title, that was fine with me. I mean, I was 2663 USCF. I was 2563 FIDE. And I wasn't playing in norm tournaments. And the funny thing is, I got my 3 norms all in the U.S., the World Open, and then I got in Chicago. Unfortunately, Savan Maradian, who passed away at a very early age of about 40, he used to run GM and IM norm tournaments in Chicago, and I got my last norm at the Spice Cup in Texas before Susan went to St. Louis. And that's at that time, that was unusual. Now it's normal to get norms at all these tournaments. And at that time, Peter Giannatos from Charlotte wasn't there yet. And so you couldn't get norms there, but now you can. He's having norm tournaments like once a month. Becoming a GM, it wasn't like I got better at 40. It was just that I played in GM norm tournaments because they were available. So that was good.
Yeah. Okay. I wondered about that. And that's kind of for listeners who heard the IM to GM special and heard these 3 guests who I referred to discuss their pursuit. That's sort of what I am Sean Nagel was saying, is like, the main thing is you got to be GM strength. Everything else is an afterthought compared to that. So, I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about how like you weren't even thinking about it, because I would think that it has made a difference for your career. Obviously, you know, with your legendary sense of humor and presentation style, I think you would have found an audience anyway. But do you think it made a big difference in terms of like making a living in chess?
It probably did. And if I had to do it over again, I probably would have tried to become a GM much earlier. I became an IM at 20 and I was 2490, which is probably higher rated than your 3 guests. And, you know, usually when you're 2490, you've been an IM for a long time. But I became one at 20 because I didn't play IM norms in the U.S. And when I was 18, I moved to Belgium, and then it was all IM norm tournaments. So I got, you know, I had 4 or 5 norms when they gave me the title. And when I moved back to the U.S. in 1992, you know, if you want to get GM norms, I had to go back to Europe, but I was already there for 4 years. I think it would have been better for my career in more than one way if I had become a GM earlier. However, we get to have interesting discussions on your podcast about how I became a GM at 40. So we would just be like, yeah, I was an IM at 20 and a GM at 23. And then you never went anywhere after that. Come on, Ben. Right. So, I mean, I guess it's somewhat reasonable for other people who want to get things at an older age, that it can be done. And I mean, when I was 36 to 39 years old, I got 3 GM norms. I mean, so, I mean, it wasn't like I was better than I used to be, but I was playing in GM norm tournaments. And it was a coincidence because there's just more tournaments that are norm friendly. And this was an unfortunate thing. A lot of people ask me, how do you get the GM title? And whether they play chess or they don't, it's a long, complicated answer.
Yeah.
It's not like, yeah, I'm really good, so I'm a GM.
Right.
It's you play it. I mean, the requirements, you just couldn't do them in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in the US, because finding a lot of foreign players in a tournament that was 9 rounds and FIDE rated, and you did really well, that, you know, you had to put them all together. And, you know, that it's not just playing good chess. And I actually told someone, when they asked me about it, I said, at some point in my career, I could have won 500 games in a row and been rated 3,100 USCF and probably wouldn't get any GM norms.
Yeah.
Because you have to play in GM norm tournaments. And people now don't understand, because every tournament's a GM norm tournament in the US now. But not 20, 30, 40 years ago. Then you had to go to Europe.
Yeah, well, it's still hard in the big open tournaments, but certainly as you mentioned, the shout out to Peter Giannatos and St. Louis, they're doing great work making these titles accessible. And it helps, as you say, to have the foreign players, but also just to have more strong players around. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were like, you know, as I recall in those days, there were like 15, 20 grandmasters in the U.S., something like that, mm-hmm. In that ballpark at least. So it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, not necessarily working harder or attaining a new peak when you got the title. But do you feel like you were near your peak at that time? Like, were you just as good as ever? Or were you already looking back on the downslope and kind of lucky to grab the title then?
It's hard for me to believe between 35 and 40, I was at my peak. I think probably I was better in my 30s than my 20s, but definitely when I got to somewhere between 40 and 44, somewhere in there, there was a clear decline in my play. And now that I'm 51 and I'll be 52 in September, it's like embarrassing. I play chess on the internet and I don't see anything. And then occasionally I'll show games that I played 30, 25, 20 years ago. And I do that thing on chess.com where it gives you a percent.
Right.
And it's like 99, 98, 99, 97. And I'm like, yeah, I used to play well. And now when I play, I lose to everybody. And I'm like, so a lot of times I think, was I never any good? And I'm just, this is the way it is. And then I'm like, oh, okay. Those games I played 30 years ago, that's pretty good. And now, you know, it's not. So obviously I'm declining, and you don't see that a lot on the internet. So I get a lot of flack for being like a low rated GM, and how are you a GM? You're terrible. And thing is, most grandmasters in their 50s aren't playing a lot of online chess and streaming it. And that's, you know, you see teenagers in 20s and early 30s. And then if you want to find a 40, 50, 60 year old streaming and playing Blitz and Bullet, good luck.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about that generally, not just from a chess strength standpoint, but from a popularity standpoint later. But right now, I want to hear a bit more about this, because first of all, you mentioned the age 43, 44. I'm 44, so I'm already way worse than you. So it's nice to hear that I can look forward to an even faster decline, Ben. Yeah. I get what you're saying. I mean, it's hard work for sure. As you get older to even maintain a level, let alone improve. But I know you're not doing private lessons anymore, Ben, but still you have a lot over the years. Have you seen adults make a significant improvement amongst your students or at the chess centers?
Oh yeah, sure. Because improvement comes from within. What am I quoting Yoda or something? you can get better if you want to get better. And if you spend all of your time asking other people, which is common, can I do this and can I do that? That's the wrong question. The question should be, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. It doesn't matter what other people say. And if you work harder than other people, you'll get better. And a lot of people have a fear of failure, which I don't have. I fail a lot. And, you know, the better you are at something, the less fear you have of failure, because that's how you get better. So if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, and you've been playing chess for a while, and you're like, oh, well, I guess I can't get any better. No, you just have to work more. You have to try harder. And if you work on your game and study a lot, look at your games, play good players, maybe get some coaching, and you believe in yourself, anybody older can get better. Now, of course, you know, if you take somebody who's one of the best players in the world, like, you know, Kasparov and Anand and so forth, you know, they're not going to get better in their 50s. And, you know, they lose, they sort of lose hope because they remember when they dominated. And now if they're number 10, 20, 30 in the world, and people are like, wow, that's pretty good for 50. They're like, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be number one. They have a lot more achievement goals. And because of that, Anand is still playing, but a lot of people are retiring early because they see they're not playing as well as they used to, and they don't like it. And a lot of people in sports could keep playing at a reasonable level, but they're like, you know, Albert Pujols is like, man, I was the best player in baseball, right. And now I'm getting cut, and I'm probably better than a lot of baseball players, but I'm not the best player in baseball. And this happens with everybody, you know, Michael Jordan. And I tell a story a lot on my stream about Robert Parrish. And I feel really bad for him because he was one of the best players. He played for the Celtics, and they were winning championships. And he played with Bird and McHale and Ainge and DJ. And then I saw him on TV when he was like 40, and he was a bench player for some team, like Chicago or Milwaukee. And he just did it for the money. But I was like, man, that guy was great. And now he's like, I hope I can keep playing. And some people do that because they love playing, like Korchnoi. And some people are like, I don't want to be 2670 FIDE if I was 2800 FIDE. I don't want to do that. I don't want to play lower level players and, you know, be worse than I used to be. So they sort of retire. And I understand both things. And I wanted this as an aside, I talk about Shaq a lot on my stream because a lot of the younger viewers don't know the good Shaq. They know the end of the career Shaq, which is
basketball two different player, people. Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, not Mama Jaro. Sorry. Yeah. And I mean, when Shaq was in his 20s, I mean, it's same with Tyson. Tyson beat everybody instantly. And then when he was older, he wasn't as good. And so when you're that person, you can decide, that's okay. I like doing what I'm doing. I'm not as good. That's all right. Or you can like choke on your own rage and be like, well, I don't want to play like this. I used to play like that. And fans are like, you're still really good because you are, but you know, you're not at the level you were. So you sort of feel bad when, you know, you do something stupid that you wouldn't have done when you were younger. Now for me, I play in less slow tournaments, not because I don't like chess anymore. I mean, there's the pandemic and there's the streaming and there's the chess center and there's family, you know, so I'm busy. But, you know, before I just played in chess tournaments and taught chess and that was it. But now there's more stuff to do.
Yeah. I mean, looking through your chess base file, as I did, I mean, you're active in invitational tournaments, like, you know, well into your 40s. So, of course, we'd love to see you out there again, but we know you're a busy man. So Ben, in one of our private previous interviews, you mentioned that you weren't really a big chess book guy. I remember you, just as I've mentioned before, for your sort of preternatural speed in 1-minute chess in particular. But what, and obviously you've also shared the advice that the best way to get better is to play stronger players and analyze the games with stronger players. But what exactly did you do? Like, what brought you to your level? And did you ever break through a plateau, or were you kind of, I mean, I know you won the GM title, but were you just kind of ascending for a long time as like someone who became very strong?
Well, my story is a lot different than 99.9% of chess players because I'm from a chess family and most people aren't. Most people learn chess somehow and their family maybe knows the rules, but As you know, Ben, my dad was a master. At his peak, he was 35th in the country. My brother got to 2300. My son got to 2260. And I was just, it was just chess at my house, and I started playing when I was five. And I got good at chess because I played so much, and I liked chess. I didn't care if I lost, which was good. But for a lot of kids, if you lose 50 games in a row, you start doing something else. And I don't know why I did this. Like, now I don't remember myself as a kid, like what I was thinking, but I would play in the highest section possible when I had no hope. So I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And instead of playing players under 1,000, I would play A players and experts, and I would get 0 out of 5 and 0 out of 4. And occasionally I'd draw or win a game. I just like playing chess. And if I lost, I was like having fun at the chess tournament. And as Bobby Fischer said, there's one thing he said I agree with. He said a lot of things I don't.
I hope so.
He said, well, actually, what he says about Morphy, I also agree with. But he said, you know, he played chess. And then he said, I just got good.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to me. Between 5 and 9, you wouldn't have noticed me at a chess tournament, except that I was really noisy. You would have said, shut that kid up. You wouldn't have said, wow, that kid's great. You would have just said, that kid's no good. Why is he even here? I guess he's here because his dad's here. And then at 10, something happened. I don't know what happened, but I was rated 11-15 when I was 9. You could imagine now, Ben, if somebody's rated 11-15 when they're 9, you know, you just drop them off at the orphanage and you're like, this isn't my kid. What's going on here? But now there's like masters at 9. But anyway, yeah. So when I was 10, I got to like 1700. I don't know how. And then every year I gained a lot of points. So when I was 12, I became 2000, 13, 2100, 14, 2200, 15, 2300. It sounds like I'm going to be the world champion when I'm 20, but you know, on that. And then I was in the 2400s, 2500s, and I was a good player. And when I went to Europe, I got a lot of IM norms. My rating went up. I played a lot of strong players. So I contribute my success to my family was a chess family. So I played in tournaments all the time. I enjoyed chess. If I lost, that was fine. There was chess in my home. And I played all the time. And eventually something clicked. Eventually. I mean, it took years before I played reasonably well. And I think 1700 is fine. But, you know, 1100 after playing for 4 years, that's not a story a grandmaster is going to tell you. That's the story of a guy who quit chess when he was 10. But yeah. I don't know what happened. I like chess a lot. And I remember a very specific story. The first time I was ever 1700, this is pre-internet, we went to the tournament and they had the USCF book of all the ratings. You couldn't actually go to the internet and find out your rating. You had to go to a tournament and open that book. And it said I was 1700 something. And my dad was like shaking his head. Like, you're not that good. It's terrible. You know? And I won the under 1800 prize clear first, that tournament. So I showed him. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think because I enjoyed chess and I didn't spend all my time thinking, how do I get better? Why didn't I get better? How come I'm not higher rated? You know, I wish I was better. I didn't care about that at all. And I guess it reminds me of not caring about the GM title. I just play chess and try to get better. And obviously I read books and I studied on the internet and I played with my dad and studied with him. But the way I got better at chess was I played a lot. And that's unusual, I think. A lot of kids nowadays have coaches and they could do 24/7 chess on the internet, either studying or playing. And they went to a lot of big tournaments. And before I was, you know, 11 years old, I just played in Michigan with the locals.
Yeah. Well, I think your story, it is unusual, especially as you noted in the fact that you were stagnant for a few years early on. Although our friend Jen Shahadi had a similar story. She didn't really take off until I think she was 13. Mm-hmm. But that's more unusual. But what's not unusual is, as a recent guest, adult improver, Dr. Luka Popov was saying, people who become grandmasters often have not had that much struggle. So once you took off, you make it sound like it was kind of like a glide path to 2300 at least. And I think that's fairly common in something that adults just, they don't have that kind of experience, at least once they've hit some sort of plateau.
And I'll tell you something which sounds like a lie. If you remember, Ben, although you might not have been alive yet, you were a little kid, when you there's something in the U.S. called a Life Master title, because the USCF likes to give away titles. Okay. And Life Master title in the 70s and 80s was you played 300 USCF rated games as a master, as 2200. And I became a master at 14 and a Life Master at 15.
Wow.
I played a lot of tournaments.
Yeah. Right.
That's crazy, yeah. But I just played a lot of chess.
Yeah, and that's not to be discounted in terms of the success that you had. Cool. Well, Ben, we got a lot of topics to hit. So I want to segue to the Chess Center, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors, aimchess.com.
Not every chess player has a janitor to help them improve at chess like Beth Harmon did. For those of you who don't, there is aimchess.com. Aimchess has a web-based algorithm that collects and analyzes your games from chess.com or Lee Chess, and then it creates personalized study plans based on your weaknesses to help you improve. It might highlight specific openings to work on, tell you to tighten up your tactics, or in my case, tell me to manage my time better. Then it gives you puzzles and advice with the goal of helping you improve your chess faster. You can check out Aim Chess for free. And then if you decide to subscribe, please use the promo code CHESS30 to save 30%. That's CHESS30. The details are also in the show notes. So for now, let's get back to the interview.
So Ben, in our prior interviews, we kind of went through the early days of the Atlanta Chess Center. In our first interview, you were just getting situated. In the second, it was starting to gain a little traction. And here we are years later, which obviously the pandemic has thrown a curveball, as we'll discuss. But before we get the update, I want to hop into the first Patreon mailbag question. This one is from an anonymous source. And this person says, what advice would you have for someone interested in opening a chess club in a major city? How did you find a venue? How did you finance it? And again, I encourage listeners to hear our prior interviews. You talk about finding a venue a little bit, but and financing, but the more granular the advice you can give, Ben, the better, I'm sure.
If you want to open a chess center like St. Louis or our center or Charlotte, it would be a good idea to have a lot of money to start. That's the best idea. That's the number one thing. It's an incredible amount of work. And that's why, since St. Louis has the most money of the three that I mentioned, they have the most employees. They have more employees than people who don't know about it know. I mean, they have a lot of employees. And this is actually how we improved the last few months. And finding a venue is not easy. We didn't have an easy time doing it. And, you know, you have to do some kind of trade-off. If you have a really nice venue, which we have, it's much more expensive. And we decided we're not going to do it on the cheap, which was a good decision. And I've mentioned him before. I think you had Stuart Rachels on, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, your old friend.
Stuart came here once to the Chess Center. And he said, wow, I thought it was, you know, going to be crap. Like, I thought it was going to be right. Like, you know, you're some guy and you're opening a chess center. I thought it was going to be, you know, like a hole in the wall. And he was really impressed that it was, you know, it's nice. And having a nice chess center in a nice neighborhood and running it properly is very expensive. So we were just very lucky because Karen and I had the same idea at the same time. Let's open a chess center, because before that, when we were going out, I was driving here, flying here, and she was driving to St. Louis. And if you wanted to go to a chess center, I live next to it. But when I moved down here permanently, we're like, what do we do? And we figure we're on the ball, and I'm a grandmaster, so some people will come. You know, if you're not a well-known person, it's much harder to open a chess center. And, you know, Rex Singfield has a lot of money and gets a lot of strong players to show up. And Peter Giannatos is an FM, and he knows the Charlotte chess scene really well. So you have to have a beginning of a lot of people know who you are in the chess world, and you have the funds to start it, and you want it to be nice, and you have to be willing to work an insane amount of hours and not make any money. So that's why there's so few chess centers. Of course, making money doesn't matter to Rex, so he has a great chess center. And it's very difficult. And luckily, Karen's the one who did everything. And I'm the pretty face. Although, wait, this is on video. So luckily, the podcast people can't see me, but you can.
Yeah.
So getting the center open was contacting every city official about every permit and having all kinds of, you know, demolition. And I mean, it took us like 9 months to open the center after we got the place, because there's so much you have to do. I recommend not opening a chess center and just moving near one of the three I mentioned. That's a lot easier.
Yeah, it does sound challenging. And as you mentioned, St. Louis is not like a replicable business model. Peter, of course, I mean, what he's pulled off in Charlotte is amazing. And also encourage listeners to check out that interview. And you did allude to in our previous interview that similar to Peter, you had some sort of founding donations where it wasn't people purchasing equity in the chess club, but you did have some people contribute to help get it off the ground. Could you provide a little more detail on how that worked?
Yeah, that's always very helpful. And that's, I mean, obviously, if you give, you know, 6, 7, 8 months notice on Facebook and Twitter and the local chess scene that you're opening a chess center, the people are really excited. And so the wealthier ones will try to help if they can. And one of the things that was interesting is for about 30 years, Thad Rogers, who's a well-known chess organizer, director, bookseller, his whole life is chess. He had a chess center in Atlanta. And about 12 years ago, I think, they closed. So people were used to going to the chess center, like they had tournaments and so forth. And so there was a big, I mean, Atlanta, Metro Atlanta is so big. There's so many people, there's so much area, and not having a chess center is weird because there's just so many people. So people are starving to try to play chess somewhere, and people wanted the chess center. So we got some help because they want to make sure that the chess center exists. They don't want it to close like the last one, even though it was open for 30 years. That doesn't help them if they're teens or 20s, they didn't get a chance to use it. So people want there to be a chess center. And obviously if you live in a big city, you'll get some help because everybody wants it. And that was good. We got a lot of support from the locals, which you would expect. And Atlanta has a lot of good players too. So it was really nice.
So do you mind saying, Ben, like how much money people kicked in and how much money you like was invested in total to get it off the ground?
I can't give you an accurate number, but I'm guessing we probably raised from local people like 5 to 10,000. And probably before we opened, we spent $40,000-$45,000 of our own money getting ready.
Holy crap. That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now again, caveat pandemic, but profitable entity at least prior to the pandemic, aside from all your online stuff.
Yeah, the pandemic, unfortunately, was good for us financially, not because of the chess center, but because of the internet.
Yeah.
So the two things that happened recently are the pandemic and the Queen's Gambit on Netflix. And because of that, a lot more people would watch my stream and Karen's stream. And we have two YouTube channels. You mentioned mine. The Chess Center also has a YouTube channel, which has between 65 and 70,000 subscribers. So everything we did on Twitch and YouTube got a lot more play, a lot more viewers when nobody could go anywhere. And people would still donate to the club to make sure we didn't close, because we were closed for about 6 months.
Right.
We weren't open to the public. And then when we did reopen, we were open 2 nights a week. So we were open like 7 hours a week. And it's very strange that we're doing this now because you don't know this. We're reopened. We're open.
Wow.
And about 5 minutes before the podcast, we all agreed we're gonna not require masks anymore.
Yeah.
And you had to have a mask in here and you had to wear it correctly. If you didn't wear it correctly, we said you got to put that mask on right. So we've been reopened for like 6 months maybe, and everybody who's come in here has a mask on, without exception. And we also moved the boards away. We did a lot of stuff so people would be comfortable and we would be comfortable. But now we're comfortable because everybody we know is vaccinated. All of our employees, me and Karen, everybody who comes here. So based on the CDC recommendation yesterday, we feel comfortable that if you want to wear a mask, fine. If you don't, then don't. And as far as we know, none of our members have ever gotten sick or gotten sick here. They did get sick during the pandemic, some of them, when we were closed and nobody could come here. I'd also like to point out, I'm not sure if this is good or bad. Some people are going to get mad and some will be like, yay. We were the first club to close when the pandemic started. We closed before Charlotte and before St. Louis and before everybody else. We were like, yeah, this isn't good. And then we were really happy a month later with our decision because then everybody else started closing down. Tough decision to make when you own a chess center and you have to close. That's not fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, Adam Weisbarth of Silver Knights in Richmond in D.C. had asked that question about how you handled reopening, but you pretty much just tackled it. And obviously you are in a unique situation in that you've got such a large following online. So you personally and for your family are able to generate income that way. But now that the Chess Center is reopening, like, is that business itself, like, would it be able to support itself with the camps and tournaments and all that stuff?
That's the goal that Karen has always tried to reach, is the Chess Center breaks even, and then our internet stuff makes a lot of money. And yeah. The Chess Center breaks even, and ever since we did the soft reopening of 2 days a week, I mean, people are starved for chess.
Yeah.
We used to get 8 to 12 for our Blitz tournament Friday night. We got 26 last week. And for our month-long tournament, where you play one game a week on Tuesday night, we used to get 8 to 16, and we got 40 last Tuesday. I mean, people want to play chess. And, you know, a lot of people, this may shock our listeners. Our listeners will be like, there's no way he's right. A lot of people don't want to play chess online. They want to play in real life.
Right.
Because that's what they've done all their life, especially people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They didn't start out playing chess on the internet, and they've been playing chess in real life all their life, and now they can't. And they're like, man, I hope I can get back to doing that. And, you know, people want their USCF rating to go up. They want to play in a tournament where they see their friends they haven't seen in a year or two. So people are starving for chess in real life. So it's coming back.
Okay. Yeah. And as I've mentioned before, anyone listening who has not tried real life chess, I encourage you all to at least try it and then see if you want to stick with it or not. But it is quite a different experience than just clicking buttons on the internet. So one more on the chess center. So you make it sound like you're basically break even at this point, but do you think with the Queen's Gambit boom, like, are you seeing a lot of new players? Do you think that you'll reach the goal of it being like profitable on its own in the coming, say, year or two?
Yeah, I think so. Every year is better than the last year. And we did see more people interested, and some of them who called even mentioned the Queen's Gambit. And we saw a lot more interest from women because, you know, you want to, looks good. You know, a woman getting, that's been a big problem in chess forever, which is getting remedied, but I don't know if it's getting remedied quickly, but it's much better than it was, is there's not enough women playing chess. Because of that, most of the best players are men, because that's the numbers. I mean, if there's 100 people playing in a tournament and there's 97 men and 3 women, that's not good. And that problem was never a problem in bridge, because I played bridge also. It's like half women, half men. So that would be good if chess was like that. And a lot of women, I think, were encouraged to play chess from Queen's Gambit. And I jokingly say on my stream, and I warn you, this may be edited from this broadcast, is that I didn't learn a lot of chess from the Queen's Gambit, but I learned a lot about drug use. So, but yeah, I mean, the Queen's Gambit, Karen and I thought it was fabulous. I mean, we thought it was really well acted, great story, mesmerizing, really interesting. Apart from the chess stuff's good too, but without chess, I thought it was great. It was just a great series. And we really enjoyed it. And a lot of people did. And they became interested in chess because chess hit a big boom, not only because of Queen's Gambit, because you can't leave your home. So you go to the internet and play chess. And a lot of famous people play chess.
So. Yeah. And it's, of course, it's good to have your wife, Karen, there at the chess center to help welcome the women who have a newfound interest in chess and make sure that they are treated well. Well, good stuff, Ben. I'm glad to hear the club's going well, although honestly, like I'm still shocked by the number of you guys sinking 45 to 50,000 of your own money into it. Like that's intense. And I commend you. That's a great investment in the chess community.
No, for a mom and pop chess club, this is really nice. I mean, it's not St. Louis, obviously, but it's nicer than a lot of chess clubs that where they actually have money, because, you know, obviously I've been to more chess clubs than maybe anybody. I've been playing chess forever. So I know what chess clubs need, and I know what people like in a chess club. And we had to make sure we had like ample parking and space. So we did a really good job getting the venue and setting it up properly and making sure that it was nice. Because if it's not nice, people don't want to come.
Yeah. Was there one thing in particular that you can think of that a lot of chess clubs were doing wrong?
Yeah, I think a lot of chess clubs, and this isn't really their fault, we just sort of got lucky, they're not inviting to a lot of different people. So if you're a grandmaster or you're a beginner, we got something here for you to do. And we have different kinds of events all the time. And we have like a welcoming atmosphere. I've been to chess clubs where I walked in and I felt like I was trespassing. Hmm. You know, it wasn't welcoming. And, you know, they're like, what are you doing here? Get out of here. I mean, that they didn't say that, but maybe that was just because it was me. but yeah, you come in our chess club. We have free Starbucks coffee. We have sofas everywhere. We have friendly people at the front desk. That's why I don't go to the front desk. And it's nice. It's like it's very well lit and everything is really nice. So I think when you go to a chess club, you know, the first impression is, do I want to be here or I don't like this place, I'm leaving. And I think that's one of the things we did right was have a welcoming atmosphere.
Okay, good stuff. All right, well, we'll leave it there on chess clubs because we got some more topics next up, and we're going to talk some chess history and world championship. But first, we're going to take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable.
This is your weekly reminder that Chessable.com has a ton of high-quality material. Whether you're looking to learn a certain opening, want to see the latest Super GM repertoire that has been published, want to find a tactics course appropriate for your level, whatever it may be, go to chessable.com and have a look around. Don't forget they have tons of cool free content too, like their short and sweet courses about various openings. And all of the things that they offer feature their proprietary move trainer technology, the secret sauce that lets you actually remember all of the new chess moves and opening sequences that you learn. So once again, chessable.com, check out their ever-expanding excellent library.
All right, Ben, we're back, and we have another Patreon mailbag question. I was listening to our old interview, and this gentleman, Rick Holland, actually submitted a question in our last interview in 2017. So, Rick, first of all, thanks for the years of support. Really appreciate it. So Rick asks, he says, you've said in the past that Kasparov is better than Carlsen because Kasparov gets into insane positions and plays them with computer-like accuracy, whereas Carlsen plays normal positions and slightly outplays his opponents. Kasparov crushes people in under 30 moves. Carlsen bleeds them dry over 60 moves. I think you make a strong case, but isn't it entirely possible that Carlsen can play insane positions as well as Kasparov and chooses not to out of laziness? I have a friend who is a great calculator in chess, but who simplifies with a small advantage whenever he can because he just doesn't feel like thinking any harder than he has to.
It's yes and no. Carlsen, I mean, the supposition of the question is Carlsen's lazy. No, Carlsen's not lazy. Yeah, you don't become world champion because you're lazy. And again, you know, the professional chess players, especially the top 10, 20 in the world. They spend a lot of time, you know, doing chess work. And if you've ever seen, I think it was Real Sports with Soledad O'Brien on HBO, maybe, when they did a story on Fabiano Caruana. I mean, Caruana said, I've memorized a million different chess positions or moves, and, you know, remembering it all isn't easy, and I study chess all day, every day. And I'm like, yeah, those are the best players in the world. So he's not lazy. It's a style thing. His technique is virtually perfect, Carlsen. And if he gets an advantage, even if it's small, in a technical position, it's just no fun. And his results are going to be better when it's boring and his opponent has very little counterplay, mainly because of the way he plays. And he certainly cannot calculate at the speed and accuracy of Kasparov, but he calculates well enough. I mean, he's a world champion. Kasparov was just really scary. If you played Kasparov, you knew you could lose in like 20 moves, even if you were like number two in the world. You were like, that guy could just run over me, and it's like embarrassing. So you're just hoping you don't blunder. And even if you lose to Magnus, which is likely, you figure like, you know, people will look at the game and be like, yeah, that guy did pretty good. And then eventually Magnus had better technique. So you're not as scared of Magnus as you are as of Kasparov. That was just super scary. Karpov wasn't afraid of Kasparov, but everybody else was. And when Magnus plays in matches or tournaments, he's always the favorite, always. However, nobody thinks Magnus is going to win a Super GM tournament by 4 points. Magnus gets 10 and second place is 6. Nobody's thinking that. And the last two world championship matches were 6-6, and he won tiebreaks. Kasparov, on the other hand, he played in tournaments with the top players in the world, and he won. The tournament was over with 4 rounds to go. I mean, he would just win. And he played for a win with black every game, which is unusual at the top level now. And I think that's why Nepomniachtchi has a good chance against Carlsen, because he's not afraid of Carlsen. And a lot of the things lower level players don't understand is when I make comments that are, you know, not highly thought of, such as
wait, that happens?
Yeah. Let's say you're 1700 USCF and you play a match with Carlsen, slow chess, and he spots you a rook or a knight, one of them. And you're like, well, I would win because, you know, I'm 1700. And one of the things they don't realize is, well, first of all, they're going to lose. But one thing they don't realize is it's really scary to sit across from somebody rated 2850, because a typical 1700 like doesn't sit across 2300s. A 2800 player is like, it's just scary being near him because they're so good. And it's hard to play your best when you're like scared of your opponent. And my dad told me, my dad played Fischer, obviously. We've talked about it previously. I mean, people were afraid of Fischer because Fischer wanted to win with white and black, and they saw him analyze, and they didn't want any of that. And Kasparov is the same. And I would actually like to play Magnus because that seems like, even though I would lose, it would be like a good thing. And I did play Magnus in the Pro Chess League, and I did lose. And he played like an engine every move because he's Magnus. But yeah, I mean, some people are just scary. I mean, you just don't want to play them because they're so aggressive. They're such good calculators. They know so much theory. And other people are just going to grind you down and you feel like you're in the game. So when you feel like you're not in the game, you don't want to play those people. And some people just have those people in their lives that aren't even necessarily better than them, but somebody has your number. There's play a guy your own rating and he always beats you. You play another guy your own rating, you always beat him. And obviously, Carlsen's so much higher rated than the typical person. It's scary to play him. It's scary to play Kasparov. And Kasparov was just more dominant. And that's the way you should judge the best players in the world. Isn't like, that's his rating, that's his rating. The way you want to judge top players is, were they much better than their peers? Were they a little better? or they weren't better at all. And to me, Carlsen's always the favorite, but he's a little better than Anand at his peak, than Caruana at his peak, and so forth. And Kasparov, Fischer, Morphy, man, you didn't want to play them. Mm-hmm. They crush you. And they were much better than other people. And when Fischer was down 2-0 against Spassky, the only reason you thought he'd lose the match is if he stopped playing. If he kept playing, he's still the big favorite because he's so scary. And yeah, some people are just always a big favorite. Like, you know, they're going to win. And you're shocked if they don't.
Kasparov did, of course, have that insanely close lifetime score with Karpov. So, I mean, he was, the two of them were head and shoulders above everyone. But
That's right. It was at the same time, which is unusual. And I point out on my stream all the time, which I haven't heard anybody else point out, if Kasparov was never born, Karpov would have been world champion forever. I mean, Karpov was better than everybody forever. And probably he would have been world champion for 25 years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, Kasparov. And those matches were really close. Karpov is so good, and people don't know it because he's sort of in Kasparov's shadow. And it's very unusual to have two people like that who are like top five of all time, and they're playing each other all the time.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's good stuff to hear you say that you think Nepo has a pretty good chance. Could you put a percentage on that?
Yeah, I've been saying for about a month now, it's about 40%.
Okay. That's significant. Yeah. Cool. Well, while we're talking chess history, Ben, I heard you mention on one of your Twitch clips that your games with Judit Polgar. So of course I went in my chess base and checked them out. Those were in your European years. Yeah. She was a young girl. What are your memories of those games in Amsterdam and Dortmund?
Well, I'll start with the first game we played, which was in the New York Open in I think it was 89. Unless it was 88. Might have been 88.
Was that like her famous breakout New York Open?
No, that was in the unrated section where she won all her games.
That's right.
Yeah. No, this was her first IM norm. And we drew in the last round that gave her first IM norm. So I played her the game that gave her first IM norm. That's how young she was. I want to tell a funny story from that event, and I'll get to your question. At the New York Open, when she was 11 or 12, she played blitz chess, I think for money, with Emery Tate. And he passed away way too early, obviously. And she won. She was ahead. They played a long series. And after the series, he said, yeah, she won, but she know who's better. And I said, yep, she's better. She does know who's better. Okay. Anyway,
hold on. We got to get a little more detail. So how old do you think she was, Ben?
She was either 11 or 12.
So was her dad putting up the money, or was she like smoking a cigarette with her handful of cash, like Gingy? Yeah. Like what was going on there?
No, I'm sure her dad was backing her. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So that was her first IM norm. Then at Hastings in England, 80 and 89. So that means the New York tournament was 87 or 88, based on my history lesson here. She played in the open section because she wasn't good enough to play in the super duper round robin. And she won. And she got a GM norm. So I was like somehow there for all of her norms. Man, and she had to draw the last round to get clear first. And she won in like 19 moves with black.
Right.
She like was going to offer a draw, but she said my position was too good. I couldn't offer a draw. So then she pulled her resign pretty quickly. And then in ORA, that was unfortunate in Amsterdam, which was in 89, because that was the best tournament I've ever had in my life up until that point. You could argue it's the best tournament I ever had. It wasn't, but it was close. And after five rounds, I had 4 out of 5. And I was one of the lowest rated players. There were like 28 players, and I was rated like 26. And I had no IM norms. I was an FM. And I beat the Dutch Olympic team and Gelfand. Wow. And I lost to Judit in the first five rounds. And I got interviewed on Dutch TV. And I thought they were going to be like, you beat the Dutch Olympic team, and you're up and coming. The whole interview was about Judit Polgar. They didn't, and then when the interview ended and they turned the camera off, she said, oh, I hear you're having a good tournament too. Well done. After it was over.
Right.
And I mean, Judah was super aggressive and scary to play and always played for a win. Very Kasparov-like. And even when she was 12, 13, 14, she was really good. Really good. And then I played her in Dortmund in 1990. This is a funny story because I played in the Bundesliga and I played for Dortmund. So I got invited to the Dortmund tournament. And they had two sections, the good section where everybody's really good, you know, like Anand and Gelfand. Then they had my section for like IMs and low-rated GMs. And I was an IM. And it was 11 rounds, 12 players, and I lost two games to Judah Polgar and Sophia Polgar. And I didn't lose any other games. The game I lost to Sophia Polgar, I was plus 4.5 after like 14 moves. And slowly it went down to zero, and then I blundered and lost. And Judah, I was black, and I had the advantage out of the opening. And actually, I was equal for a long time. And then in time trouble, my king ran up the board and got mated. That was a good idea by me getting in time trouble. But yeah, I've been friends with the family forever. And something you may not know is a student of mine went to Budapest for a Norm tournament, and I was his coach. I went with him. And this was in, I think, 1990. I could be a year off. And I had the Polgar's address. So we found their place, and I knocked on the door. They didn't know I was there. And they answered. They're like, Ben. They couldn't believe that. Like, yeah, they were all there. The three good Polgar sisters, the mom and the dad. And then we hung out for like an hour, and they were telling me where good vegetarian restaurants were because I was a vegetarian then. And I think they were too.
I was going to ask, and how is Laszlo's English, by the way? I've always wanted to interview him.
Yeah, I've spoken to him and seemed fine to me. I mean, it's been a long time.
Right.
Now, what's funny is Laszlo was speaking to somebody, and Susan was telling, this is, you know, 30 some years ago. Susan's like, yeah, a lot of us speak a lot of languages, but my dad, he doesn't speak Russian. And he was speaking Russian to the guy he was talking to. So I don't know. I think they all speak a lot of languages.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how his English is now because I haven't spoken to him in such a long time. So I don't know if he could do a long interview, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, amazing.
Probably he could.
Yeah, I bet he could. Amazing stories. I'll have to try to. I'll go knock on his door.
Yeah, there you go.
Tell him I know Ben Feingold. All right. Well, good stuff, Ben. We also got to talk about your Twitch explosion. I believe, as we were alluding to earlier, the oldest chess Twitch star, right?
Well, we're trying to figure out who the oldest Twitch streamers were, and we concluded that in chess, Karen is the oldest female who streams, my wife. We could be wrong, but that's what we concluded. And somebody said for like strong chess players, the oldest one is somebody who almost never streams, and that's John Spielman.
He's older than me. Spielman. Yeah.
He doesn't stream very much. He doesn't have a lot of followers. So if you mean like top 20, top 30 chess streamers in number of views, that I think I'm easily the oldest. Yeah. I'm always the oldest. I used to be always the youngest. Then something happened.
Yeah. So what's the secret to your success, Ben?
I can give some secrets if people want to Twitch stream. The first secret is you have to stream all the time. You can't stream and then take a week off and then stream again and then say you can't do that. If you want people to follow your stream, you have to be active. And your stream has to not be boring, which is very hard for a lot of people. And it's very hard for me to be boring, so I'm sort of a natural for Twitch streaming. Because unlike a lot of people who are even my rating, I can talk nonstop with the chat and play like Bullet and Blitz. And when Karen's streaming, she's doing one or the other.
Yeah.
She's not like playing and like, hey, chat. You know, she don't do that. So a lot of people just can't do that because their level of play will go down, but I don't care. I mean, I literally don't care. Hopefully you get that reference. Yes. And obviously the most popular, Hikaru, he could, you know, he could probably juggle and eat and leave the chat and play 1 minute and, you know, play ping pong at the same time. So he's very popular because he's not sitting there looking at the screen and ignoring the chat and not talking. He don't do that. And a lot of people do because they're so focused on the chess that they're playing. So being interesting is more important than being good, which is good for me because I'm not as good as like Eric Hansen. I'm not as good as Hikaru Nakamura or any of the other grandmasters who are popular in stream, but maybe I'm more interesting for some people. And obviously, the Botez sisters, a lot of people incorrectly say like, well, they're just popular because they're women. That doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of women in the world. And they're by far the most popular women who stream chess. So other women who stream chess, some of them get 5 viewers. That's not why they're popular. They're popular because they work hard and people hate that. Like, no, don't work hard. Just, you know, as soon as you stream, I want 20 videos on YouTube and I want them edited. I want it 5 seconds later. And obviously, if you're working hard on your stream and you're working hard on your stream when you're not on your stream and you have a team of people and you're energetic and funny like they are, then you get a lot of viewers. And that, again, that's more important than what your rating is. And a lot of people just give the wrong reason why people are popular. They're like, well, he's 2,800. He's popular. I'll tell you somebody who's 2,800 who was not popular, and that was Fabi. Caruana streamed, I don't know, 5-10 times about 2-3 years ago, and Fabi didn't say anything. He just played chess. And he didn't do like what me and Hikaru do, like, you know, schmooze it up. And then he didn't like it, and he's trying to become world chess champion, so he just stopped. I mean,
reasonable.
You can't
goal.
Donate all of your resources to streaming when you're trying to become world champion.
Yeah. Easy. Yeah, which makes Ali Reza is streaming, and I don't pop in on Twitch all that often, but when I do, it seems like he has a few hundred viewers. So might be a similar dynamic at play where, I mean, obviously he's a wonder to watch play chess, but
I actually like his stream because he does talk to the audience and he plays music like the music that he likes, and you know, obviously he's a billion times better than I am, so. But yeah, he's a billion times better than me, but he doesn't get more viewers because I've been streaming longer than him and I stream more often than he does. If he streams once a week, his channel will never get popular. And it could be he doesn't care because he's trying to become world champion. He just streams for fun.
Yeah.
It couldn't be like his life goal is to have the best Twitch stream.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, and financially, it's obviously the correct decision. Eric Hansen would have been 2,700 easily if he never streamed, and he took the decision to use most of his time on streaming, and he has the most subs, more subs than Hikaru, him and Amon Hambleton. And, you know, his rating as a result didn't keep going up, even though he was in his early 20s because he spent all his time streaming.
Do they have more subs than Hikaru?
What's that?
They have more subs than Hikaru?
They had way more subs than Hikaru. At one point, they had 23,000 subs and he had like 8,000 at the same time. And, you know, he lost a lot of subs when the shit hit the fan, and then he's got most of them back now. Now everybody's happy. But, you know, when there's drama, sometimes you have a dip and then you know, things fluctuate a lot. And Eric obviously had his own drama. You don't follow Twitch as much as some people, but
I'm aware of these dramas. But Ben, since it came up, you might as well explain them to our listeners, because we have some blissfully out of touch people like myself who might not be familiar.
Well, I want to explain the drama like in a general way, not in the specific situation.
Okay.
So one of the things that everyone does wrong, I don't mean in chess, is they judge people. First of all, judging people is, first of all, not okay. But second of all, they judge people on like 4 seconds of their life.
This is a very common moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, so Eric Hansen and Hikaru and me, we're putting out content. We're using all of our energy and time to entertain people, play some chess, talk some trash, and people love it. Okay. Then occasionally, sometimes more than occasionally, we say things we shouldn't say. Obviously, if you're talking 6 days a week, several hours at a time, and you're trying to be entertaining, some things you say, maybe you shouldn't have said. And occasionally, I won't even put my stream on YouTube because I'm like, nah, I shouldn't have said that stuff. And if I say 7 million things and three of them I shouldn't have said, that's not a reason to say, oh, I don't like that guy because he said three things I don't like. And otherwise, he's great. And that's what people on the internet do. And so, you know, occasionally Hikaru, Eric, and I, probably I'm the worst offender, we say things that we wish we didn't say, or, you know, maybe they're very controversial and there's no reason to say it, and people get mad. And there are some people like John Bartholomew and Eric Rosen who don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, they've never said anything controversial or people will get mad and not watch them. And so those streams are very popular. And then Anna Rudolph, Anna Kramling. Now, I'm sure the Botez sisters have said things they wish they didn't say. But, you know, that happens when you're just like nonstop on Twitch and YouTube. Occasionally you say something you shouldn't have said. And if that's the norm, like with Joe Rogan, for example, I don't want to watch it. If you just say crazy things all the time because you want to be crazy, because you want to get viewers, that's not my cup of tea. But if most of the stuff you say is interesting and informative and funny, and then, you know, occasionally you say something you shouldn't say, that's not a reason to hate somebody. They can just say, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. And now it's back to my 20 more hours of entertainment you like. So, you know, and unlike a lot of the other streamers, the chess bras, and they don't hide it, they might have some alcohol. They might have some substances that may or may not be legal. And, you know, if you get in that kind of state, you might say some stuff you wish you didn't say. So, and also I think with Hikaru, what people don't understand is Hikaru and me and Botez and Hanson, big streamers, I'm not as big as they are, but, you know, I'm getting there. There's a team of people. And if somebody on your team is, sometimes they're not helpful. they hurt your stream. It happens. And, you know, you got a lot of people working for you. Everything you, I mean, people probably think this Ben, you know, you does the podcast and 3 minutes later it's ready. And it's not how it is. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into getting the, you know, there's just a lot of work that you do. And people don't realize the work that's put in, and then they get angry at like one thing, especially if other people tell them to.
Right.
So if I say Hikaru's the worst, people who are fans of me be like, yeah, he's the worst. Ben said so. And if Hikaru says Eric Hansen's the worst, oh yeah, Hikaru said so. And you know, we're playing to the crowd and we all know each other and everything's fine, but you know, sometimes you say things you shouldn't say, or you're trash talking a little too much, and you know, and so forth. But it's entertainment. People watch us instead of sitting at home doing nothing. So it's good for everybody.
Cool. Well, I like the way you framed that. It's important. And obviously in the comedy world, you see this sort of thing all the time where like they're professional talkers, they're doing crowd work, and then they say one thing and you know, their career can be over. Do you worry about that happening to you, Ben?
I mean, Karen does.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, you got to be who you are. You can't. And I've made a lot of decisions in my life that were very bad decisions or very financially bad decisions, and that's because I'm me. That's what I do. I do me. So if you don't like me, then you don't have to watch. That's what I tell people. They're like, I hate this stream. I'm like, watch the stream you like. Like, why are you watching my stream if you hate it? Like, watch somebody else's stream. I even suggest. I'm like, you'll like these people because they're not like me. Right. And I don't have to watch stuff you hate it. And so I don't really worry about that. I have other personal reasons I don't worry about it, which we could talk about off top.
Interesting,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean... people get offended easily, and you know, if Eric or me or the Botez sisters or Hikaru or anybody else is really upset or really offended or offends somebody else, as far as I'm concerned, like by the next day, it's over. Whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Akaru and I did a stream together. We played a sub battle. And, you know, I mean, it's fine. And if people find it interesting, the chess drama, that's fine with me. You know? And obviously, it can cost you a lot of viewers. And then eventually you get it back because they forget, sort of like the Sunny episode where Wolf Cola and Boko Haram and Fight Milk, if you know this episode I'm talking about. Dennis is like, look, in 24 hours, something else is going to happen. Then we're in the clear. We have to survive.
That's funny.
And it turned out like the thing they were in trouble for, their friends who work at the bar, they got in trouble for something else. So now they were in the clear. Now okay. they didn't care anymore. And that's what happens in chess drama is somebody says something and then, and I told Eric, you got to thank me a lot because when Eric had his issues on stream, very soon thereafter, people were after me and they forgot about Eric. So that's good.
Yeah.
And the troubles that Karu had about a month or two ago, that helped me tremendously. That doesn't make any sense. Like, if you hate me, why are you not hating me because somebody else? I mean, like, what? But they're just like, okay, this happened. So now I'm going to concentrate on this.
There's no such thing as bad publicity, Ben.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. And obviously, listeners who want to know more, there's stuff all over the internet about this. But I think we should move on to a tangentially related topic. So this one, we got a hard-hitting question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast, Jonathan Slater. So thank you for the support, Jonathan. And Jonathan says, Ben, that's you, Ben, not me. Because no one loves my Perpetual Chess YouTube channel without images. So Ben, I love your channel on YouTube and your great content, but for the love of God, please sort out your clip strategy. When that guy was taking your content and releasing 2-minute clips, it was hilarious. I get why you stopped him, but you have to do the same or get someone to do it for you. Rant over. I love Ben. From Jonathan.
Okay, I mean, he's wrong, but you have the right to be wrong. This is, you know, people on the internet always have suggestions about things. People stealing your content is wrong, and we don't let them do it. And
I don't
nobody,
think he's saying it's right. He's saying your clips were great.
No, the clips are great. That's right. We agree. And the guy was a nice guy. And, you know, so the guy showing this stuff, it doesn't matter if it makes us money or makes you more popular. It doesn't matter to us. Can't steal our stuff. Okay. Now, the second part is he's also wrong about, shocking. My channel has changed a lot in the last few months, both of our channels, and we do have many shorter clips. Actually, we're starting a series next Monday, although it has to be put on the internet, where I'm going to do like 5-minute opening videos because we want to do some opening videos because those are popular. But the attention span of the typical viewer is, you know, like 5 seconds. I alluded to the Family Guy, shocking. There's an episode where they do a podcast. So you should watch this episode if you haven't. And they decide people's attention spans are pretty bad. So they call it the 6-second podcast. So it's 6 seconds. And they're like, our guest is Bare Naked Ladies. Goodbye. Yeah. Okay. And then they did a podcast and Peter spoke really fast. And he said, like, I don't know, 50 words. And the podcast ended. And they said, how was it? He says, it dragged a little. So, okay. But if you look at our channel and look at our videos from a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, either on Twitch or YouTube, and we have 2 Twitch channels and 2 YouTube channels. And then you look at the last 6 months, there's many more videos that are short. And the other thing people don't realize, which we talked about before the broadcast, is how much work it takes to do everything. So you can't just snap your fingers and have a clip and make sure it's edited properly and it's what you want and it has a good thumbnail and it doesn't interfere with your other videos. So as a consequence, we had my son Spencer, he worked here for over a year, maybe close to 2 years. Yeah, I think 2 years he worked here. Then he decided he wanted to stream and teach more and just do it from his home. So he gave us notice and he decided to go another way in his chess. He wants to play in tournaments and stream and give lessons and not do some of the work here, which isn't necessarily chess work. And as we decided, we wanted to build our channels more, and we had the funds to do it, which is always the issue. So we hired a lot of people.
Right.
So now we got a lot of people working on the website, the YouTube channels, the Twitch channels, and other stuff. And that's expensive. And just saying, do this, do this, do this, you know, if you want to donate $100,000, we'll do all that. But you can't just do it. You have to make the content. You have to put the content out there. And you have to make sure the content's good. And he's right that, unfortunately, people like really short videos. And this is well known. And to get those really short videos, you just need a lot of employees, a good team, people who are good at their jobs. And there's so much content that we have, sometimes it's a curse. I mean, if I'm streaming every day and the streams are 3 hours, and then the suggestion is, hey, of those 3 hour videos, make five minute videos, which is a good idea. But how are we going to make 1,000 videos when there's just me and Karen?
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to do what they want you to do. And the reason some people can do it better than others is they have more people working for them, or maybe they hired like super professionals. It's very expensive. So we have good people working for us. So the complaints that people have are getting solved incrementally, but there's never an end to the complaints. No matter what we do, they're like, why aren't you doing this? And why aren't you doing that? And a lot of the things people complain about, we are doing. They just don't know we're doing them.
Okay.
But, yeah. I mean, it's tough to put so much content out, and it's free content, but they still complain.
Yeah. But suffice to say, it sounds like you're continuing to reinvest in the business and make incremental improvements. So
mm-hmm. That's right. There's a lot going on here that's not our YouTube channel and our Twitch channel. We have a chess center to run.
Yeah.
Karen has two kids. We have two dogs. I have two adult children. We have tournaments. We have camps. We have classes. It's not just our whole lives are the Twitch and the YouTube. So we have to hire more people that are, you know, good, like really good at their jobs. And we did. You know, we just hire anybody and they're like, yeah, I'm good at whatever. You know, they're not. You got to interview people and find people who could do what you want them to do.
Okay, good to hear. We've got one more Patreon mailbag question. This one is from Stefan Bagria, who says, I am a huge fan of GM Feingold Scholastic work and his very entertaining streaming. I would love to hear which great players of the past would have been perfect for today's chess streaming.
Oh, yeah, I like that question.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good question.
And he said,
I think Nidorf, he suggested Nidorf. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Number one that comes to my mind is Luboyevich. Lubomir Luboyevich, man, he's very entertaining. And he was entertaining all the GMs, the super GMs at tournaments. I mean,
he's... Emery Tate, of course.
Emery Tate, but, you know, Emery Tate might get more trouble than I do. I
mean, right.
Emery Tate, you got to watch it. I mean, yeah, that's the not safe for work. But, yeah, he's very entertaining. You know, RIP, obviously. And Luboyevich is probably still entertaining, but he's getting older now, so he's probably less entertaining.
Yeah, 70 years of age.
I mean, he was the most fun at every tournament.
What made him so fun?
Oh man, he talked nonstop, and he speaks every language. He can switch languages while he's talking. He's crazy. And here's the best thing about Luboyevich. He'll say something. And then he'll stop and say the opposite. It's sort of like the Rick James and the Chappelle show. He's like, I didn't do that. And I did do that. And he'll say, white's completely winning. White's better. Oh, no, I like black, actually. Right. And other GMs don't want to say that even if they believe it. They don't want to like embarrass themselves. He don't care. He's like, yeah. He just loves chess. So if you love chess and you want to talk about it, that's very interesting. So yeah, Nidorf for sure. Luboyevich for sure. I'm trying to think how far back to go, because for a lot of people, like 2000 was a long time to go. But for me, it's like, you know, 1950, 1960.
Did you ever cross paths with Mikhail Tal, Ben?
I saw him a couple of times. The first time I saw him is like a magical story. I went to the World Chess Festival in February 88 in St. John, New Brunswick, Canada. And we just got there. That was a great event. We could spend a whole podcast talking about that event. Anyway, I walked into a Skittles room and there was a blitz game going on. I didn't know who was playing because there were a billion people surrounding the table watching. So I was looking in there and it was Tall playing blitz with Zapata. And it's funny because Zapata lives in Atlanta now. Everybody lives in Atlanta, I guess. So they're just playing a friendly blitz game. I looked at the position. Tall was down a queen, and he had a knight on d6 that was the greatest knight I ever saw. And that was his compensation. Like, he didn't have a mate. It wasn't winning material. That knight was really good, and he won. He just kept getting better position, and the queen didn't matter. And I was like, man, I mean, that's the Tall I want to see, and that's the Tall that I saw. And he actually won the World Blitz Championship that year at St. John. Everybody played. Karpov played, Kasparov played, everybody played. And Tall won clear. It was a knockout. Tall won, and it was $50,000 first in 1988 for a blitz tournament.
Yeah.
Unheard of. But, I mean, Tall was really good at blitz chess, and in 88, he wasn't going to live much longer. He didn't look too good, but his chess was – and I saw Tall the first time in my life, but I didn't, you know, and talk to him in 79 in Montreal, where he tied for first with Karpov with 10 out of 14. And I mean, so when Tall was older, he was still really good. I mean, but I never got a chance to like hang out with him and talk to him, play him. Cause you know, I only saw him two or three times.
Did you see him enough to have a sense? Cause obviously his charismatic personality and his personal issues are legendary, but was he outgoing? Like, would he have been a good streamer?
Oh yeah. No, for sure. The thing is, it's very hard for Tall not to drink and smoke. He could not drink on stream, but there's no way he would not smoke. There's no way. I don't know if you're supposed to smoke cigarettes on stream. I guess you can.
He
liked to drink and smoke. And so it'd be hard to talk a lot because he's, but yeah, he was, he loved chess, and that's the people who are the best streamers, who they're not like boring people who say, I guess I can make money streaming. They're people who love chess. They want to stream. They're outgoing people. They like the back and forth with everybody, and it seems like they're having a good time. So, and that would be Tall.
Good stuff. So Ben, I've got one more sort of topic to hit on. Obviously in your Twitch stream, you've got the Twitch bot reminding us about Sasha Chapin's All the Wrong Moves. I had the privilege of interviewing him, and as I've mentioned, greatly enjoyed his book, where you make a cameo, obviously, as someone who taught him. So I'm sure you've talked about this on stream, but I'd like for you to sort of walk us through that experience, and then I want to ask you about the secret, last but not least. But let's hear your perspective on Sasha's story.
Yeah, when I first read the secret, I was like, "What secret?" Anyway, not kidding. But but I know the secret. So maybe 5 years ago, I'm close. It's either 5 or 6. He came to the chess club in St. Louis, and maybe he contacted me before that. And he said, I'm writing a book and I like chess and I want to get chess lessons and talk to you. And it was funny. He was surprised when we discussed what could be in the book. And I said, anything I say could be in the book. And he was like, really? I was like, yeah, I don't care. Put it in the book. And he's like, okay. And we talked a lot about like chess in general, like what chess was and tournaments and who's good and who's not, you know, like we talked about chess, like as a general thing. So he would learn more about the chess world. And we had chess lessons also where I would critique his games and, you know, I gave him lessons. Maybe I gave him 10 lessons in 2 months, something like that. And then, you know, he disappeared. And then like the book came out and, you know, a lot of guys say they write a book, but no, then you know, the book never comes out or nobody reads it. But he's a great writer, very interesting and very popular. And you know, Howard Stern and George Stephanopoulos, I guess, both gave the book thumbs up, so people started reading it. And one of the greatest compliments I ever got was Howard Stern was talking about the book and my name came up and Howard Stern said, you can actually find it online if you're good at looking online. It's not easy to find it. He said, Ben Feingold is endlessly entertaining. And I was like, man, from Howard Stern, that's a pretty good compliment.
Yeah, wow.
I was surprised you knew who I was. But and I mean, the book is a great book. It's not just like, you know, here's a chess game. It's like his experiences in chess. And, you know, the big secret, I guess, is what he's talking about is it's not a secret. It's never blunder. And I told him, it doesn't matter how well you play. You can play like Carlsen, or you can play like Akita, just learn the moves, as long as you never blunder. If you play like Carlsen for 20 moves and then hang your queen, you hang mate in one, those other moves don't matter. Chess often, even at the highest levels, is decided by one move. So you and your opponent play at a similar level, maybe even dissimilar. Maybe, you know, Ben, you're like 2150, 2200, around there, and you play a 1500, and you're just playing better than him. And the engine says you're plus 1.7. Now, if you blunder your queen or blunder mate, that didn't matter. So if you never blunder, your level doesn't matter very much. You're just going to win a lot. And I told him, if you're going to blunder three times a game and your other 37 moves are great, you're going to lose a lot. So don't blunder. And he said, okay, I'll try. And you know, we have secrets of how not to blunder. And when you're in time trouble, that's why you shouldn't get in time trouble. And it's just hard not to get in time trouble. It's really tough. And by the way, you'll notice Napoleon Diachi has pretty good results, and he's not in time trouble very often. He's a pretty fast player.
Yeah, the opposite, if anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, Sasha's book is called All the Wrong Moves. And shout out to Neil Bruce. I couldn't access my book due to some construction in my house, my All the Wrong Moves. And he dug up the quote, which is the secret that Ben just spoiled. So, but it doesn't ruin the book at all. But anyway, no. You have to play like you never want the game to end, was one of the money quotes.
That's right.
And speaking of ending, Ben, I think we can wrap up this podcast, but this has been amazing as always. Anything you want to hit before we,
I want to like, thank our new employees. We've hired a lot of people in the last like 3 months, and they're really good employees, and that's really enhanced our center and our online presence. And people notice that we just have thumbnails that are pretty funny on all our videos now, and they're edited and they come out more quickly because we hired more people. And to be successful, you have to have a good team. And the Chess Center wouldn't exist without my wife Karen, and people on my stream when they see Karen, like, Karen, what do you do?
A lot.
24 hours a day to make sure that the Chess Center is works. And there's just so much to do when you run a business. And I just do the chess stuff. I don't edit videos. I don't pay the rent. I don't pay the utilities. I don't hire people. I don't clean anything. I don't organize the tournaments and make flyers and make sure that our website, I don't do anything. And that's all she does all day. And, you know, I say, hi, I'm Ben Feingold. Give me money.
Yeah.
People think that I'm good.
Well, shout out to Karen. And what were the names of the people who are helping you guys out?
We have a video editor who actually lives in North Carolina that her brother knows because her brother was a provost in North Carolina in Greensboro. I'm not sure they want us to say their names, actually. I think this person in particular doesn't.
Okay.
But we have about 4 or 5 people that we have to give checks to every couple of weeks that we didn't 3 or 4 months ago.
Cool.
So because of that, I love to see
the success, Ben. I know it's been a long journey, and it's great to see people appreciate your storytelling and chess and pop culture knowledge.
Cool.
Excellent, Ben. Well, we'll hope to do this again someday. And thanks as always for all the great stories.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. Great to be on.
Thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy. Thanks to you all for listening. And thanks to those of you who help spread the word, whether it be positive reviews on podcast platforms, telling friends, social media, All that stuff helps get the word out, and it is much appreciated. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group to continue the conversation, sometimes even with that week's guests. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action as well, at Perpetual Chess. And you can also find all these links on the Perpetual Chess webpage, perpetualchesspod.com. But of course, the main purpose of these closing credits is to thank everyone who supports Perpetual Chess financially. Without you all, we would not be able to put out such a consistent and hopefully quality product. So thanks so much. It really means the world to me. And in particular, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities, starting off with my friends at chessable.com. Aside from that, I would like to thank David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com. He is the coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, our friends at Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprend Chess Twitch channel, A Needy Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Essentials Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Guvin Manet, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jeff Martinson, Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, one of the original chess YouTube channels, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the legendary Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodhi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Reverend Roy Fry, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patsers, which is a chess.com improver group. You can look them up. Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of chessengland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovics, Antonio Cancino, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Potzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, also known as Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Butson, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Decker, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Emmanuel Langual, Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Fide Arbiter, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Geert Vandervelde, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumost, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John Tooley, Juan Almaguar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of US Chess, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, IM Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, IM Kostya Kovutsky of The Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Malijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott McKinnon, Scott Shepard, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwater, Walter, Sergey Magakon, Seth Ruzicka, Shane Unger, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rattel, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.